It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a massive great white shark named Mary Jane became a celebrity a few years ago. We'll find out more about her and why our guest says the era of shark fear is over in favor of an era of shark conservation.
First, there's been a lot of attention nationwide focused on states that have implemented new laws requiring voters to provide photo identification at the polls.
Supporters of these laws say they prevent voter fraud at the polls. Opponents say the laws disproportionately affect Black, Latino, and younger voters throughout the country.
Wisconsin's voter photo ID law is currently being challenged in federal court. The trial has been going on this week. It will pick up again next week. Laurel White's covering the case. She's a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, this voter ID law passed a few years back in and out of effect because of other court challenges. What's being challenged in this current case?
Well, you guys kind of summarized it just now. Basically, the plaintiff in this case, One Wisconsin Institute, which is a liberal group, they're saying that the law has a disproportionate impact on people of color and young people, and generally people who tend to vote for Democratic candidates.
And what have we heard so far from witnesses sympathetic to the plaintiff in this?
Sure. So witnesses for the plaintiff so far have been a few people who have had trouble getting the state-issued IDs that are now required to vote. We've also heard from some experts on elections and voter fraud, as well as some administrators for the state, folks who work at the Department of Motor Vehicles that issues the IDs. Today we heard from the head of the State Elections Board as well.
And it's not just the voter ID law, in effect, that they're talking about, right? It sounds like, from what I've seen mostly in your reporting, Laurel, is it's more about the overall voting climate in Wisconsin.
That's right. They're actually looking at more than a dozen voting-related laws that have been enacted in Wisconsin since 2011. So there's quite a bit here. And actually, as you mention it, that's one of the arguments that the state mentioned in their opening statements on Monday, that this lawsuit is incredibly broad. And the lawyer for the state said that the plaintiffs are trying to throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at them in their attempt to take down these laws.
One of the angles that has come up in the lawsuit, and you reported on this, testimony from state officials and others about Black and Latino residents in the state who have been denied state IDs. Can you talk us through what's going on there?
Sure. So it's kind of a complicated, wonky process. So basically what happens is if you don't have a driver's license or another state-issued ID that you now need to get to the polls, you can go in and enter this petition process to get an ID. And you have to enter the petition process if you can't present a birth certificate or some other form of vital document. So according to the state, about 1,300 people have entered this special petition process. They say that's about 2% of people who are coming in to get state IDs that are now required. And what testimony revealed yesterday is that 85% of the people who have entered that petition process and have been denied are either Black or Latino.
And has the state had an explanation in their defense of this?
Well, you know, a lot of the problems that people are having when they enter the petition process, you know, they enter it because they don't have that birth certificate. They don't have that form of vital document. So they enter the process and the state offers some help to them in locating those documents. And a lot of people aren't able to find them because they don't really exist, or they seem to not exist. So the majority of people, or not the majority, so 36% of people who were denied a photo ID were actually born in the South, usually to a midwife, or, you know, with the help of a midwife. So there might not be a birth certificate available, or if it did exist, it's been lost. So I think that obviously affects a certain demographic of people, African Americans, people born in the South in a certain time period. And so that's where a lot of those rejections are coming from.
We're talking to state capitol reporter Laurel White from Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at a court challenge to the state's voter ID laws. It's been going on in court. She has been covering it. This started off with a person who made some news about a month ago, a former Republican legislative aide who testified about how Republican legislators talked about and thought about the voter ID laws. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was one of the most, I think it's fair to say, one of the most dramatic moments of the trial so far. That was on Monday, just after the opening arguments. And that former aide was in the room as the voter ID law was making its way through the legislative process. So he was there for a Republican-only meeting called a caucus that's not open to the public, just legislators and some staff members. And what he did was he got up on the stand on Monday and described his perception of the tone in the room, which he said was, I believe the word he used was giddy, that some Republican lawmakers were very excited about the law and were fairly open about the fact that it would, that it could be a difficult thing for certain voters to deal with or to understand.
And how did the state, and I should say the state as represented by attorneys from the Attorney General's office, as I understand it, how did the state respond to that?
Sure. Well, the state had been aware that this individual had some contact with the media about his experience. This hearing was in 2011 when the voter ID law was starting to work its way through the legislature, and he just now became vocal about it. I believe it was about a month ago, as you mentioned. So the state was prepared for him to come up and to give this testimony. And what was unique about his testimony this time, he actually named names of legislators that he thought were particularly pleased with the law. And so the state focused on that and said, you know, you hadn't named names before. You know, was that because you thought legislators would dispute? They were sort of prepared for his statement and did what they could to dispute it.
Now, let's talk about the setting here. What is the court? What do we know about the judge? And what's taken it to this federal court so far?
Sure. So this is a federal court in Madison. The trial is expected to last 9 days. So we're in the middle of day five right now. And the climate for voter ID in Wisconsin is complicated. There's another voter ID trial that's currently making its way through the courts that was brought on by the American Civil Liberties Union. It was struck down by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, later pushed back to a lower court to consider a small part of the original suit. Cases on voter ID all around the country are swirling. Virginia's law, I believe, was just upheld today or yesterday, very recently. So there's a lot going on where voter ID is concerned in Wisconsin and elsewhere. So it's a complicated thing and a hectic time.
You mentioned this is the midst of a 9-day trial. It'll pick up next week. I don't know if they telegraph this kind of thing. Do you know what is expected to happen next week in testimony?
Well, we do have a list. Both the plaintiffs and the defense had to provide a list of all of the witnesses that they plan on calling. So we've heard from, as I mentioned before, some experts on elections, some state workers, people who've had challenges getting IDs. We're going to expect to hear from even more of those folks in the next 4 days after today, I guess 4.5 days. We haven't had many witnesses called by the defense, by the state, quite yet. So I think we're all, those who've been watching the trial and covering it, we're anticipating what those defense witnesses end up sharing with the court. Obviously, they're going to be defending the voter ID law and its implementation. So we'll get a little bit more of their side in the coming days.
We'll step outside the courtroom for a moment, Laurel. The Government Accountability Board had asked the legislature to provide some funding for an education campaign about the voter ID law. Some Republican lawmakers signed on in support of that, asking the Joint Finance Committee to provide that. Governor Walker made an emergency rule, making it a little easier to get ID for people who are having trouble. by and large, this is in the courts, but the state is moving forward on preparing to use voter ID again this fall, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, things are complicated, as I mentioned, but everybody's planning on the voter ID law being in place for the November election. Turnout for the April presidential primary was quite high. So I think folks are expecting that to be the same in November. So they're planning, hoping to roll out educational campaigns. That's what the Government Accountability Board was requesting funding to do, and what the Republican legislators said that they were in support of yesterday. And Governor Walker did issue that emergency rule, I believe that was 2 weeks ago now, to help some of the folks going through that petition process that I mentioned earlier. So everybody is anticipating, it seems, that voter ID is going to be in place in November, and they're doing what they can to make sure that folks are informed and as prepared as they can be.
Laurel, we'll talk to you again when the dust settles.
Sounds great, Rob.
That's Laurel White. She's state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She joined us to talk about the ongoing voter ID trial currently in federal court. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we can all use a little time out of our day to relax and enjoy a cup of coffee and a snack. We'll learn some lessons on how to unwind from Sweden on Food Friday.
Right now, with swimming season around the corner, there are still people who are afraid to go in the water all these years later because of Jaws. But our next guest says we can better understand shark behavior to prevent shark attacks, makes the case for shark conservation as a key part of ocean ecosystem health.
Brian Scarry is with us now. He's an award-winning National Geographic photojournalist and a leading voice for shark and marine conservation. His work is featured in the current National Geographic series, The Summer of Sharks. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here, Veronica. Thanks.
Well, you've been involved with shark conservation efforts, marine conservation efforts for years. With sharks, I understand you swim with them, you photograph them. So as someone who has lived pretty closely with sharks over the years, what have you seen that makes you love them?
Well, you know, as a photographer, they are a magical subject. They truly represent this terrific blend of grace and power. They exude this great confidence, but yet they move very elegantly and exquisitely through the water. So photographically, they're a terrific subject to return to time and time again. But, you know, there's been somewhat of an evolution in my career with many animals in the ocean, just beginning out as a photographer many years ago, wanting to make pretty pictures of them, and then seeing that these animals are in trouble, that they're facing a lot of peril out there in the ocean and on our planet, and wanting to sort of give them a bit of a makeover to show them as something more than just a one-dimensional monster.
And how do you do that? I mean, especially after kind of the bad PR that Jaws gave sharks, and which reverberated for a really long time, some echo still today. I mean, how do you make the shark over into something that people have that same feeling that you have about it, something that needs protection?
Right. Well, you know, for me, I think it's about portraying them accurately, which means, you know, I'm not trying to make them out to be something that they're not. They are indeed apex predators. They are, you know, a fearsome animal, something that is to be respected. But I think for a very long time, sharks have been seen sort of in that one-dimensional view, that they are this shadowy villain that is swimming beneath the surface just waiting to eat you. And, you know, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. They're not house pets. They're not kittens and puppies that we want to necessarily hug, but yet they are not villains and one-dimensional creatures. So for me, photographically, it's about showing them as something magnificent, showing that each species, and there's probably over 400 or close to 500 species of sharks, but to show that each one has unique characteristics, that they have amazing biology, and, you know, although we may never feel the same way about a fish that we do about some warm, fuzzy mammal, we can certainly, I think, appreciate them and regard them with this degree of respect.
And in terms of, you know, swimming season being around the corner, and inevitably there are stories of shark attacks every summer, what does science tell us about shark behavior that could minimize that kind of story and that kind of incident?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, whenever we go out into the wild, there's always a potential for risk, whether we're walking in a forest or swimming in the ocean. And when we go into a place like the ocean where sharks might be around, I think there is a sense of risk, but there's also some things that we can do. I think researchers have showed us that if you're going in the water maybe at dusk, I mean, sometimes it seems that sharks, particular species, like to feed at dusk, or if somebody is fishing nearby. I think a lot of the attacks that have happened in recent years, we've seen that either the person who got bit or somebody was near somebody fishing, you know, so if you're surf casting and you're fishing and you've got a string of fish that are bleeding into the water, well, that might attract sharks. If the visibility is bad and a shark might mistake you for something else that they're normally going to eat, a type of fish, if the vis isn't very good, those are things that we can do, you know, prevent those attacks or prevent those bites that sometimes occur, is to just be sort of a little cognizant of what we might be doing. You know, if you're in a place where certain species that feed on marine mammals, if you're in a place where great white sharks might be seen and there's seals around and you're on a boogie board and it sort of is reminiscent of a seal from below, it looks like a silhouette of a seal, that might not be a good behavior to engage in. So, you know, I think there are things we can do, but at the end of the day, you know, going into the ocean, if there's a sharky sort of place around, is not without risk.
We're talking with Brian Skerry right now from National Geographic, where he's a photojournalist and a leading voice for shark and marine conservation. His work is featured in the current National Geographic series called The Summer of Sharks. And in terms of seeing sharks for their majesty and not just as this predator, it seems as though the tide could be turning on that a bit. Brian, I know that there was a particular great white shark. So this is the big one, the one that Jaws sort of demonized. There was a shark that got a name, Mary Jane. Can you tell us about her?
Well, yes. A number of researchers, particularly on the east coast of the United States in recent years, have been tagging animals, and oftentimes they name them. And I think that this helps the public sort of give some personality to these animals. And an animal like Mary Lee or others that have been tagged on the East Coast, you can now track through websites where the satellite tagging data will show this animal's movements and migrations. But I think what this sort of science has helped to do is give some personality to these animals. You know, a scientific paper was just published about a year or two ago by a researcher in Massachusetts that stated that great white sharks, he believes, are living well into their 70s. It was previously thought that they only lived maybe 30 or 35 years old, but now we sort of have this parallel with human lifetime, you know, age and 70 years old. And you've got a solitary predator for large part, a solitary animal that's out there migrating thousands of miles throughout the Atlantic Ocean, and at times they're up in the very northern reaches of the Atlantic, and other times they're down south in Florida or Gulf of Mexico. But, you know, what wisdom might this 18-foot-long, you know, several-thousand-pound animal that's in her 60s or 70s contain? You know, they might have wisdom of the ocean that we can't even imagine. So I think those kinds of things, like tagging and naming animals and tracking their movements, helps people to see them in a new way.
Let's circle back to the beginning of our conversation. You talked about seeing not just the shark for a photographic opportunity, but seeing them as an animal in peril. What challenges and perils do sharks face around the world?
Well, you know, today, right now, Veronica, in excess of 100 million sharks are being killed every single year. And that's been going on for some time. It's a staggering number, and it's almost hard to comprehend, but it's a fact. And the reason that 100 million sharks are being killed is oftentimes just for their fins, for the soup fin trade that's, you know, popular in Asia. And the methods of catching these sharks can be everything from long lines where, you know, 100 miles of lines will be put out with thousands of baited hooks or gill nets or many other methods that are being used to kill sharks. And when you think about the role that predators play in keeping an ecosystem healthy, you realize that the notion of killing 100 million sharks just doesn't seem wise. The ocean is so important to our existence. Whether you're living in a landlocked state like Wisconsin, you still have to recognize that every other breath that a human being takes, more than 50% of the oxygen we breathe, comes from the ocean. And, you know, killing 100 million sharks is probably not in our own best interest.
So as you said, here we are in Wisconsin. landlocked state. Is there anything that we can do here to help with shark conservation and marine conservation?
Well, I think, you know, as with so many things, it's about awareness, becoming educated about these things. Obviously, if you have an opportunity to order shark fin soup, I would say don't do that. But let your voice be known. I mean, we can elect people who care about ocean conservation and conservation of the natural world in general, who support, you know, the notion of climate change, which is having a devastating effect on the ocean, and ocean acidification, and all of these things that ultimately do affect us. I mean, it shouldn't be only about our own self-interest, but at the end of the day, that's what motivates people. And I think, you know, the choices we make using single-use plastic containers, you know, there's a lot of plastics in the ocean. Reports came out recently that said that by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than there are fish. All of this stuff matters to the health of the sea, to the health of sharks and the animals that live there. So I think being aware, being educated, making good decisions as a consumer and you know, acting politically all make a really important difference in the state of our planet.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. I appreciate it.
That's Brian Scarry, a journalist with National Geographic, photojournalist, and a leading voice for shark and marine conservation. His work is featured in the current National Geographic series. It's called The Summer of Sharks.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll learn about the art of taking a proper coffee break like they do in Sweden, and we've got recipes to go along with it. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about Wisconsin's drunkest cities, Waukesha's water plan, and more for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, saying you need a coffee break while you're at work might just mean taking a couple of minutes to run out and grab a coffee before drinking that coffee at your desk while you keep on working.
But in Sweden, there's fika. It's a whole ritual revolving around taking a break and enjoying a coffee and a snack. It allows you to unplug and relax and catch up with the people around you.
Join us now to talk about fika and some traditional foods you can find at a Swedish shop or make yourself. We'll have some recipes. We have Johanna Kindvall and Anna Bronis. Johanna is an illustrator and a food blogger. Anna is a food writer and a blogger. Together, they co-wrote the new book. It's called Fika, The Art of the Swedish Coffee Break. Johanna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right, Anna, we gave a little taste of it there, but can you give us a little more detail? What is this, and are we saying it right? Fika, F-I-K-A.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got your Swedish down pat. yeah, so fika is can be used as a verb. It can also be used as a noun. So you can fika, you can take a fika, you can have a fika. And it's basically just a Swedish coffee break. So most often that's coffee with something to go with it. That can be a sweet item, like a cinnamon roll or cardamom bun, or sometimes it can even be a savory thing, like an open-faced sandwich paired with a cup of coffee.
And Johanna, it sounds as though the Swedish version of fika is not simply the food and the coffee. It's also almost a ritual. It's a kind of a way of life that hits the pause button where people really get to relax with each other or by themselves. How would you describe that part of it?
That's totally right. And if you work in an office, it's they often have a break in the morning and in the afternoon. And it's a way to, walk away from your desk and talk with your co-workers. It could be about anything, really. Most of the time they don't talk really about the work, or it's more about, what are you doing this weekend, or what's the latest TV show, and so on. And it also makes you put your focus on something else for a while, and I believe that you work better when you go back to your desk.
Anna,
whatever you do.
Anna, you're Swedish-American. Now, here in the United States, I mean, on this show, we tend to eat lunch working at our desk, eat our snacks at the desk, drink our coffee at a desk. Can this successfully translate into the United States?
Yeah, well, I think that we've seen a lot of change in coffee culture in the U.S., in the last 10 years or so. And I think we have a more of an embrace of a slower coffee lifestyle with the rise of more cafes where people do go to sit down. And I think that we're all sort of in need of something to get us to slow down. And I think we should also keep in mind that, you know, Sweden is in no way a country where, you know, everyone takes these long breaks. It's, you know, if you go to Stockholm and you go to busy city centers, of course people are working a lot, and, you know, you may not find that they're slowing down a lot, but I think there is this sort of embrace of, even if it's just for a few minutes, but just kind of take a step back and take a moment to just, you know, take a time out really from what you're doing and slow down. And I think we'd really want that here in the States. So I see no reason why we can't be doing more of it.
And Johanna, what do you think it is that's special about the food and drink aspect of fika? So it sounds very simple. It's a coffee break, right? You have a cup of coffee, maybe you have a sweet roll. What makes this a little more special?
I think it's, yeah, you can do it by yourself, but you can also do it with others. And most times you do it with others. But I think the special thing is that you start doing something else. You go away. I mean, if you're out shopping with a friend, you can sit down and have a break and have a fika. It's also sometimes also like the neighbor comes in and you have a fika with that person. So I think the difference is that you actually sit down somewhere else, and that's very important, I think.
We are reinventing the coffee break in the United States with the help of Sweden. We're talking to the authors of the new book, Fika, The Art of the Swedish Coffee Break. We have Johanna Kinvall and Anna Bronis with us now. Let's start to get to some of the food. I understand that these things are cinnamon buns and cardamom buns. Johanna, I'll ruin this here. Vetebular?
Vetebular, yes.
Not too bad. So tell us what a vetebular is and how we make that.
Oh, vetebular is a sweet dough that is made of yeast and milk and flour and sugar. And not so much sugar. They're not so sweet, really, but then you often fill them with cinnamon and butter and sugar, or cardamom and butter. And sugar, of course, and you roll them into different shapes, and then you put some eggs on them, and the white sugar that we call pärlsocker, which is a pearl sugar that actually doesn't melt in the oven, and you can also put nuts on them, of course, and there's other fillings as well, like almond paste and a lot of orange and lots of different.
Now, are these complicated and time-consuming to make? I know with a typical sort of yeasted roll, it's a bit of a time investment.
Yes, it is. But it's not so bad. It takes quite quick to put it together, and then you let it rise for an hour, and then you shape it, and then you let it rise a little bit more, like an hour more, I think, and then you bake it. And the baking is quite quick; it's like 10 minutes.
We've got that recipe, by the way, at WPR.org. Find the Central Time page, and we've got actually a few recipes from the book there. Let's check out another one. This is the one that I'm insisting somebody make soon. It's a hazelnut. Well, it's sort of a hazelnut coffee cake, but it's not really a coffee cake. Hazelnutskaka med kaffe. Huh? Pretty close there? Anna?
Yeah, good job.
Now, this one, it's not really a coffee cake, but it's a cake as hazelnut, and then there's coffee added into it, which sounds fantastic. Can you talk us through that one, Anna?
Yeah, so a really common cake that you'll find in Sweden is a sockerkaka, which basically means sugar cake. Similar sort of to a sponge cake here in the U.S., except a little bit denser. And so there are a couple cakes in the book that Johanna and I did that are sort of riffs off of that. So this one, what's a little bit different about it, is that it's made with mostly hazelnuts. There's a little bit of flour in there, but it's mostly ground hazelnuts. And that gives it a really nice texture as well as flavor, because we toast the hazelnuts before grinding them. So it gives you this kind of like well-bodied flavor, which then paired with a little bit of coffee in it just makes cakes, but if you love coffee, you will love this cake, I promise, because it's dense, it's moist, and it just has this really nice coffee flavor. And when I say dense, I don't mean like a really, really heavy cake, because it's made using eggs. And what we do is we actually separate the egg yolk and the egg white, and then the egg white is whipped into kind of a meringue. So it gives it kind of this like a bit lighter of a flavor, but you're still getting that moist texture that I really like in cake. I'm really opposed to dry cake, so this is the perfect cake in my opinion.
So a couple of things strike me listening to you talk about the cinnamon rolls and the hazelnut coffee cake. One is that they sound delicious and I want to eat them. But the other thing is that in America, if you try to sell people on stopping twice a day and eating cake, basically, people are so afraid of sugar, Anna. Are people going to cotton on to this, given that, you know, you're basically eating cake a couple extra times a day?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that often if you go to Sweden, even if people are taking coffee breaks every day, you know, they're not eating a huge piece of cake at 10 a.m. in the morning and 2 p.m. in the afternoon every single day. You know, if they are eating something sweet, it's probably a very small amount. And then you'll often find that on weekends there'll be a fika that's a bit more special. So maybe then you'll indulge in something a little bit bigger. And I think that the important thing with the recipes in this book is that the focus is that it's all, you know, it's all whole ingredients, it's all natural ingredients. And in our opinion, Johanna and I really believe in the idea that if you use good ingredients, then you have a really good flavor, and then you don't need to eat as much. So you can get away with eating, you know, you just need a smaller slice of the cake or a smaller cookie, and that's going to be really satisfying. But certainly, I think a lot of Swedes will tell you that, you know, they're not eating 3 cardamom buns a day. as Julia Child said once, you know, all good things in moderation, including moderation. Mm-hmm.
And as a counterpoint, what happens when donuts show up here at Wisconsin Public Radio? Many of us seem to have no trouble eating them. But Johanna, you mentioned in the book has some savory recipes in it for rye bread and things like that. It isn't just the sweet stuff, right? Sometimes people do some kind of open-faced sandwich or a savory ingredient, Johanna.
Yeah, no, that's true. And often when you go to a cafe and in the afternoon with a friend, it's not always you choose to have a cinnamon bun, for example, but so then you can choose to have an open-faced sandwich instead. And often they're very simple. Often it's just with cheese and a little bit of red pepper or cucumber or pickles. And it could also be a liver pasté and with the pickles. Which sounds maybe odd to have with the coffee, but it works. And and it's also like, if you haven't had so much for lunch, you may think it's nicer to have a sandwich. But they're often very small, so it's a good treat.
We're talking right now with Johanna Kinvall. She's an illustrator and food blogger, and Anna Bronis, a freelance food writer. And they're the co-authors of today's Food Friday discussion, Fika, the Art of the Swedish Coffee Break.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. A lot of different questions for you. First, do you like this idea of a more dedicated a coffee break during the workday, a coffee break with some kind of treats? Do you do this, or do you wish you did it? And then have you had these kind of Swedish sweet snacks, these cakes, Hasselnutskaka Medcafe, Semlor, Vetabular? I get way more opportunity to try Swedish on the show than I ever would have thought. We've got recipes for those three things that I just missaid over on the Wisconsin Public Radio website. Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And for this week's Food Friday, we're talking about the art of the Swedish coffee break. And we want to hear from you. Do you wish that you could take more time out of your day to unwind with a cup of coffee, maybe a little open-faced rye sandwich and a cardamom bun to go along with it? Well, give us a call. Let us know what you think. The Central Time Facebook page works too. Our number to call in is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And you have a favorite Swedish-style pastry, whether for regular day use or for special occasions. We're talking to food writer Anna Bronis and food writer and illustrator Johanna Kinvall. Their new book is called Fika, The Art of the Swedish Coffee Break. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Jean on the line in Madison. Jean, hi.
Hi. I actually just went to Sweden in April, and it was really wonderful. I was doing some research in a museum, and so got to experience Fika in the workplace firsthand. And I have to say, it is, in fact, a really wonderful little break in the afternoon, a chance to mingle with other researchers and coworkers. And, you know, it was an interesting way to do, like, afternoon collaboration over really good coffee and sweet.
So you did talk shop a little bit. You did talk about work things during this week, this coffee break.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of it was social, but because, you know, it's a museum, people were working on things that were of mutual interest. And so it was very, very fun.
And Jean, I got to ask, did you have a favorite treat on these breaks?
Oh, those cinnamon buns. I don't know what they put in them, but they're so good.
Jean, thank you so much for sharing that. So, Johanna, people do talk about work. It isn't just sociable, but they're stepping away from the day-to-day tasks during this, aren't they?
Yeah, no, definitely. And also, I was thinking now when I heard Jean that it's actually also really to get to know your coworkers better. When I started work here in New York, it was something that I missed a lot, that we didn't have those breaks that I could actually get to know my new colleagues. And so I felt it took much longer time to get into the group. So Fika have a good purpose there.
Interesting. Dual purposes there for Fika. Well, thanks a lot, Jean, for that call. And we're going to go next to Deborah joining us from Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hi, I'm actually from the UP of Michigan, but anyway, my grandfather was from Stockholm, but our neighbors when I was a child were from the Lundqvist. They were Swedish, and they would make, I believe they were called rosettes, and I wondered if your guest could help me on this, but there was like a rosette iron, and you dipped it into batter and then into hot oil on the stove. Oh, they were just awesome.
And they're kind of thin and crispy, aren't they, at least the ones I'm thinking of. What about that, Anna, rosettes?
Yeah, Johanna might be better able to answer this question than I am, but those are a little bit older, and I think that they do them more in Norway than in Sweden, but I think Johanna might be able to answer that better than I can.
They're definitely common in Sweden, but I think it's all they're old recipe, and I think it's more the older who does it, the older generation. But I remember them when I was growing up in the countryside, and they're called Klenetta, I think.
Klenetta.
All right, Deborah, thanks so much for the call at 800-642-1234. That reminds me, that sounds like more of a holiday treat, and you've got a section of the book devoted to more special occasion things. One of the recipes we've got on the Wisconsin Public Radio website is semlor, a Swedish cream bun. Can you tell us about that, Johanna?
Semlor, yeah, those are, you eat them for Fat Tuesday in the in the autumn? No, what I'm saying.
In the spring, yep.
Early, late winter. But in Sweden, they actually start to sell them already after Christmas, and they have them in the cafes and bakeries for 3 months, pretty much. And it is a bun. It's very similar to the same dough as the cinnamon bun, but you make them as a bun, and then you cut them in half, and you take some of the bread out, and you fill it with almond paste, and then cream, and then you put the top on. And they're delicious.
These are called semlor, and we also have this recipe up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. If you want to start planning your weekend fika or your next the workday fika, and I want to ask you, Johanna, following up on what you said about it being a social occasion, do you have any tips if people want to institute their own workplace fika? How would you approach it?
Can you take that again?
If you want to start up a fika here in the United States, how do you suggest getting people on board?
I will suggest that you alternate to bring in something to share, like cookies or like a cake, or and it doesn't have to be so much, but and it doesn't have to be home baked, but it would be nice. and then you alternate. Maybe you start with once a week, like Friday afternoon, and I think that would be a good start.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, do you think we could pull this off here? I don't know.
I mean, we should try for sure, yeah. And you could be on the first round of baking.
Yeah, I'm such a good baker. Well, you know, the funny thing is, all this talk of sweets, and maybe we've had too many sweets lately, what I'm really in the mood for is good rye bread. And Anna, you've got a recipe for a Swedish-style rye bread. What's the secret to making, for those who bake bread at home, making a good rye bread?
Yeah, well, so the recipe in there, what we did is that Johanna, I love this, that she's been doing this for a while, is that traditionally rye bread often is made with a dark syrup, which sort of the equivalent of that here is molasses, and it gives us this kind of like sweet flavor. But what I love what Johanna does is she uses prunes to give a little bit of sweetness to the bread, but without using, a sweetener. And that gives us this like sort of sweeter, more well-rounded flavor that pairs with, we have anise seeds in that one, so it gives it kind of this like spicy, sweet flavor. And so there are lots of different recipes for rye bread out there, but ours in particular is done over 2 days, actually. So the night before, you put boiling water on the rye flour, and that's kind of an older method that allows it to be a bit more elastic. And rye flour itself has a lower gluten content in it, so it doesn't rise in the same way that traditional wheat flour does. So this allows it to kind of expand. And then the next day, what you do is you go in and you make the bread as you would. You add in regular flour and yeast, and then you end up with these two beautiful loaves of this like dark, hearty bread. The kind of bread that we talked about nutrition earlier, but with this type of bread, you really only need a thin slice. You know, if you have an open space sandwich, you take one or two thin slices of that, put some stuff on top. I mean, that's kind of all you need. You don't need to eat the whole loaf to feel satisfied, and you probably would stop yourself far before you got to that point.
And Johanna, once we have these two beautiful loaves of rye bread, what is your favorite way to top them off for your fika?
Oh, I think that cheese is one of my favorites on that bread, but also actually cured ham is also really, really nice, especially the one they do for Christmas in Sweden, which is cured and often quite mildly spiced with some cloves and stuff like that, but really, really delicious on that bread. Herring, of course.
Of course.
That doesn't work with coffee, though.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
That was Johanna.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Johanna Kinvall. She's an illustrator and blogger. Anna Bronas is a food writer and blogger. They co-wrote the cookbook we've been talking about, Fika, The Art of the Swedish Coffee Break. I'm talking about ways to expand and enhance our concept of the coffee break. And again, head over to Wisconsin Public Radio's website, WPR.org. Find Central Time. We've got a few of their recipes to make your coffee breaks next week a heck of a lot more fun. Yesterday, we hosted the show from our studio in downtown Milwaukee. And during the show, we invited you to share your ideas for great ways to enjoy the city. You told us on the air about restaurants, tourist spots, and more in the Milwaukee area.
And then we heard even more after the show on social media. On Facebook, Becky tells us, we had an awesome time doing the Milwaukee Ghost Tour in the Third Ward. It's full of great history stories, she says.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm guessing it's not too crazy scary.
Yeah, it sounds like it's more about history.
Right.
And there are surprising, I mean, lots of historic buildings. There are a surprising amount of ghost stories in old Milwaukee, as I understand it.
Yeah, I've done a lot of museums there, but I think that's something I haven't done is take tours in the Milwaukee area. That's something I really should do. We also heard from Nick, who writes, don't forget the safe house, sliding doors, secret passwords, and great food, not to mention the wall of signatures and closed circuit TV to watch the first timers earn their way in.
And we want to take a moment now to thank the amazing WPR Milwaukee team for hosting us there, for helping us out, making us feel at home, and the tremendous WPR engineering staff who helped make it all possible.
And thanks to the Central Time team back at home base. And now that we've made the trip, we'll want to do it again and visit some of our other bureaus around the state for broadcasts, too.
Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at the biggest news from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.